Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, Noam Chomsky explains more of the ways the wealthy and powerful first make you pay for the knife and then stab you in the back. I hope you'll stay tuned. This is the third of our shows, devoted, at least in part, to Noam Chomsky's excellent conversation with Ralph Nader. The conversation took place in May 2017. Back in May, a film had just been released on Chomsky's ideas, and also a book. Both are titled Requiem for the American Dream, 10 Principles of Concentration of Wealth and Power. And as George Carlin reminds us, they call it the American Dream because you have to be asleep to believe it. But back to Chomsky. I gather that the book and the film are like an updated version of that nonfiction bestseller of the 1530s, Machiavelli's The Prince. But the audience is different. Machiavelli is advising rulers on how to rule. Chomsky is advising the ruler's subjects on how our rulers are actually ruling us. Chomsky identifies 10 principles by which our rich and powerful nullify democracy. How they keep themselves rich and powerful by keeping the 99% poor or relatively poor and absolutely powerless. In the two previous installments, we heard Chomsky and his interviewer, Ralph Nader, discuss these 7 principles. 1. Reduce democracy. 2. Shape ideology. 3. Redesign the economy. 4. Shift the burden. 5. Attack solidarity. 6. Run the regulators. And some of part 7, engineer elections. The discussion actually weaves back and forth a bit among these points. When the previous installment stopped, Chomsky and Nader were talking about how the financial fat cats got away with economic murder after 2007. Or more precisely, how they got away with criminal plunder. We'll pick up there, and then move on to principles 8, 9, and 10. They are, keep the rabble in line, manufacture consent, and marginalize the population. How to turn a democracy into a plutocracy in 10 easy steps. From May 2017, here are Noam Chomsky and Ralph Nader.
The much worse 2007-2008 crash, nobody was punished. There were fines. In fact, big fines, like the J.P. Morgan Chase, biggest bank, I think it had something like maybe a $13 billion fine. But when you take a look at it, first of all, it's tax deductible. Secondly, they have all kind of ways around it, and their profits are huge. And they ended up, the banks that were responsible for the crisis ended up richer than they were before. Now, there was an attempt at some kind of control afterwards, the Dodd-Frank legislation to try to prevent, at least limit, the next major crisis. But that's now being dismantled by the Trump administration, which is exactly as you say, is a kind of caricature of the deregulatory efforts to free the corporate sector from any kinds of constraints so the wealthy can continue to enrich themselves, you know, beyond the dreams of avarice. And of course, it's exactly as you said, the cabinet appointments, it would be almost comical if the consequences weren't so awful. But each one is in the hands of someone who wants to undermine the functions of that cabinet. We see it already in the legislations and executive orders that are being sneaked through. A lot of it's Paul Ryan's initiative, the more savage fringe of the old Republican Party. policies which are undermining what's left of workers' rights, of occupational safety rights, of the horrible health program that they're pushing through, basically amounts to a big tax cut for the rich at the expense of the most vulnerable parts of the population, who by design of the program will be thrown out of the health system. These are systematic policies to try to carry the more savage fringe of the neoliberal programs into effect, into implementation. Incidentally, with regard to the financial institutions, it's worth mentioning that they survive on a public subsidy. There was a very significant study of the International Monetary Fund a couple of years ago, which investigated the profits of the major U.S. banks, J.P. Morgan Chase, Goldman Sachs, the others. And what they found is that their profits almost entirely rely upon a tacit government insurance policy, what's called informally too big to fail. Now, that doesn't just count the periodic bailouts. It means all sorts of other things, like, for example, they're able to get cheap credit. They get inflated credit ratings because it's understood that if they get into trouble, they'll be bailed out by the taxpayer. There's an incentive to undertake risky and hence, at least in the short term, profitable transactions in the knowledge that if they collapse, which they will, the taxpayer will be called upon to bail them out. The business press, Bloomberg, Business Week, using this study, estimated the annual subsidy at about maybe $80 billion or more. These are really predatory institutions. And we should add that that subsidy is peanuts as compared to the taxpayer subsidy for the energy industries, for agribusiness and other major industries. So all the talk about free market and so on is substantially a joke when you actually look into how it works. This is the taxpayer subsidizing their own repression by supporting predatory institutions who act for their own benefit, of course, that's what they're for, and in ways which often harm the public, as these statistics on income distribution show, on declining wages, on declining democracy, and so on. And it's not just the United States.
That's true. I noticed that Principle 7, 8, and 9 have a very logical link. Engineer elections, Principle 7, keep the rabble in line, an old-fashioned word for the masses of the people, Principle 8, yeah. And manufacturing consent, Principle 9. And what you see around the country is not only are the candidates in the pockets of the paymasters, mostly from the corporate world, but they've gotten the people to vote against their own interests because the choices are so narrow between the Democratic and Republican parties that people end up, for example, if they can't stand Hillary Clinton, they vote for Trump, often in a very impulsive manner. And the worst example of that manufacturing consent that is hardly ever mentioned is access to the courts. They've actually persuaded a majority of people that there are too many frivolous suits and wrongfully injured people get too much money, when the facts are that less than 2% of wrongful injury ever get into the court to begin with, and that we're using the courts at a lower level in terms of civil lawsuits than was the case per capita in 1840. And so part of the manufacturing consent is, I guess, turning people against their own interests by throwing them up against the wall and having a media, mass media system that does not demonstrate what's going on in the country, in effect entertains and deceives. So how do you weave all that together in terms of a controlling system by the few over the many?
Well, there's an interesting image that's been proposed by some of the analysts and investigators who've done the most significant study of this paradox, as it's sometimes called, that people who are being undermined by political decisions are voting in favor of the candidates who are undermining them. Arlie Hochschild is one of those who's studied this in some depth. In
Strangers in Our Own Land. That's right. Her book.
It's very interesting.
And what's going on in Appalachia now.
Yeah.
Yes.
Same thing. And the image that comes out, which the people themselves accept, is an image of people standing in a line. We're standing in a line. Behind us are our parents and our grandparents who worked hard and tried to fulfill the American dream. They had traditional families. They did the right thing. They were religious. And they got ahead. So they were moving along ahead in line. That's the American dream. All of a sudden, the line has stalled. We're standing in line, and it's stalled, or maybe even declined. Up ahead of us, there are people who are flying into the stratosphere, you know, unbelievable wealth. But that doesn't bother us, because the propaganda system, which we internalize, tells us, okay, that's the American dream. They're working hard and getting ahead, mostly a joke, but that's the image. What worries them is the people behind them. And now we get the scapegoating aspect of the propaganda system. Ronald Reagan and his fairy tales about welfare mothers, by implication black women, rich women driving in limousines to the welfare office to pick up your hard-earned contributions for Social Security or whatever, that story. So the people behind us, according to the imagery, are worthless, they don't work hard, they're the wrong color, and so on and so forth. And what does the federal government do? The role of the federal government is to help those worthless people behind us get ahead of us with food stamps, with affirmative action, with welfare programs. So that's the role of the federal government. So therefore, we should hate the government, not hate the concentrated wealth, which is corporate power, which is determining these policies. We don't see them. They're not part of the system. We see the federal government helping the worthless people behind us get ahead of us while we are stuck in the line. That's the imagery. And that's a pretty effective way of controlling people. And I suspect we're going to see more of that in the near future. Trump's promises, you know, I'm going to bring jobs back, we're going to have a steel industry. Of course, they're not going to be realized. And what happens when they're not realized? We should remember that quite a few of the working class Trump voters voted for Obama in 2008. They believed, or at least put faith in, his promises of hope and change. Well, they pretty soon found out there was no hope and no change. So they were disillusioned, angry, ended up with their voting for their class enemy, who was shafting them at every possible moment. Well, what happens when these people realize that the promises once again were a delusion? At that point, the government, the ruling powers, corporate, private, and state, are going to be forced to turn to more extreme scapegoating to direct the anger and disillusionment somewhere else, not to us, but somewhere else. Who's the someone else? Well, there's a long history of this. The most vulnerable parts of the population, or even of the vulnerable foreigners. And that could turn out to be pretty ugly. I mean, this is the moment to act constructively to try to prevent all of this. And there are ways of doing it. Again, the Sanders phenomenon, it was pretty remarkable. As I say, it broke from over a century of political tradition. And in fact, thanks to Fox News, we know their polls they ran, that the most popular political figure in the country by a huge margin is Bernie Sanders. All of this indicates opportunities that are available to turn the tide if those opportunities are taken. You have to understand what's happening and then act, you know.
And one of the ways consent is manufactured is to divide and rule so that people turn against each other, red state, blue state, left, right, conservative, liberal, and don't focus on the oligarchies and the plutocracies who are basically focusing people's attention on where they disagree with each other, like reproductive rights, school prayer, gun control, and not where there's a huge left-right consensus on many of the economic issues, the civil liberties issues, the cracking down on corporate crime, the opposition to crony capitalism, what we call corporate welfare, even criminal justice reform. So this divide and rule, I saw how this worked, Professor Chomsky, once when I read that Senator James Inhofe, Republican of Oklahoma, who thinks climate change is a hoax and now has enormous influence in the Senate and over the EPA on climate change policy. He was once asked, how do you win these elections, Senator Inhofe in Oklahoma? And he smiled and he said, simple. It's God, gays, and guns. And that sort of sums up that divide and rule situation, which distracts people away from, let's face it, the few who are oppressing them economically and all other serious ways that impair a decent livelihood, fulfilling their human potential, and passing on something better to their children and grandchildren. So in your last 10, principle 10 is marginalizing the population. Would you elaborate on that?
Yeah, you're exactly right. The problem for concentrated power, corporate and state power, the problem is the general public. The general public is always an enemy of concentrated power. We saw that, for example, in discussing the quite similar Powell Memorandum and Trilateral Commission Crisis of Democracy. They're concerned with the public. People aren't being indoctrinated enough. They're getting too active. We have to marginalize them somehow. We have to break up the kinds of institutions, like particularly labor unions, in which they can join together to act to pursue their own interests. Incidentally, the same is true of political parties. The United States doesn't really have political parties. That's been true for a long time. It has candidate-producing elites. So you can't be a member of the Democratic Party the way you can be a member of the Labour Party in England, for example. What you can do is show up every once in a while and put a mark in a ballot where they tell you, here's a possible candidate. That's quite different from a political party in which people actually participate in forming the policies, in advancing them, and so on. There's a little of that here, but not much. But any organization that brings people together is dangerous. They have to be separated and marginalized. And your point about the common beliefs across the spectrum on crucial issues, that's essential. So, for example, the things you mentioned are quite accurate, and there are plenty of others. Like, for example, raising taxes on the rich. Now, that's been a popular demand for as long as polls have been taken, 40 years more. Right now, it's the same across the spectrum. Meanwhile, taxes on the rich go down. That's one of many indices of the separation of state corporate power from the popular will. And the same is true on a host of other issues. So take one that's really primary in people's lives and is right on the front pages now, health care. Take a look at polls over a long period. There's been very substantial support for what every other developed country has, some form of national health care. The U.S. health care system is an international scandal. It's over twice the per capita costs of comparable countries and has some of the poorest outcomes, mainly because it's privatized. Highly bureaucratic, inefficient, very costly, in the hands of institutions like insurance companies, which are not concerned with health, but with profit and so on.
It's basically, Professor Chomsky, a pay-or-die situation. Look at the drug price escalation in recent years. I mean, far higher than any place in the world, and we're the ones who subsidize these drug companies through the National Institutes of Health and give them all kinds of free clinically tested medicine with no royalties and no reasonable price provisions. As you say, a majority of the people, latest Pew poll show, they want full Medicare for all, everybody in, nobody out, free choice of doctor, comes in half the price per capita, that's what the figures are in Canada, and saves tens of thousands of lives.
You know, that goes way back. So at the end of the Reagan administration, for example, about 70% of the population thought that the right to public health care should be in the Constitution. And about 40% thought it already was in the Constitution. People don't know what's in the Constitution. They just assume it's whatever makes sense. And this makes so much sense, it must be in the Constitution. When Obama put through the Affordable Care Act, of course, there was some talk about a public option, meaning essentially Medicare for all. And about almost two-thirds of the population supported that. But it was just dismissed. The United States is, I think, the only country where the government is forbidden by law from negotiating drug prices. So, say, the Pentagon can negotiate her paper clips or whatever, but the government cannot negotiate with the pharmaceutical companies for drug prices outside the Veterans Administration. That's one reason why we have highly inflated drug prices way beyond other countries. There are public attitudes on this. There was a Kaiser poll right at the time of the Affordable Care Act, which found that about 85% of the population were opposed to this, but it didn't matter. It didn't enter the discussion and debate. I mean, those are crucial issues. And these are things on which, if you take, say, Trump voter, many of the Trump voters and many of the Sanders voters, you'd find that they have pretty similar concerns. There is a real possibility of putting together a progressive coalition which will be concerned with rights, justice, access to the courts, decent jobs, progress, creating, not fulfilling, the partly mythical American dream. That can be done. We have the resources for it. We have opportunities. And there's an enormous struggle to prevent it from happening by atomizing people in a huge number of ways. One of the ways, incidentally, is just by fostering kind of extreme consumerism, trying to drive into people's heads the idea that the only thing that matters is how many commodities you have. Nothing else matters. Huge amounts of effort are poured into hundreds of billion dollars a year to try to create this imagery. These are major efforts, all aimed at manufacturing consent, subordination, atomization, marginalization, preventing people from joining together to pursue the goals that they do in fact want but aren't being offered to them in the political system, while the main actors are being hidden, the concentrated wealth and power.
As a matter of fact, in spite of the propaganda and manufacturing consent, there are huge areas of support from people of different political labeling, conservative, liberal, for civil liberties, for example, for changing the war on drugs, for example, for changing the corporate tax system and those tax havens. Even Ron Paul and Barney Frank got together in the House on the bloated military budget. Polls always start out against these wars of aggression before the soldiers go over there and dissent is shut down. I found in the consumer and environmental area huge. When you get down off the abstraction ladder, Professor Chomsky, you can see where people live, work, and raise their families. The ideology tends to dissipate, and they focus, regardless of whether they're conservatives or liberals, wanting their children to have good schools, drink pure water, breathe clean air, eat safe food. And that's what we've got to provide a cutting-edge movement for, because once that consensus breaks 70% and is supported by left and right, it's politically unstoppable in Congress and state legislatures, and the nature of elections begin changing. Well, before we conclude, we've been talking with Professor Noam Chomsky of MIT, author of many books on power, structure, abuse of foreign and military practices, as well as the need to build our democracy. He's the author of Requiem for the American Dream, and it's based on a film that's getting widespread attention here and abroad. It's also called Requiem for the American Dream. Sometimes the plutocrats and the oligarchs go too far. They cross certain lines that are insufferable even by the established legal order, much less the mass media. What do you think the prospects are of Donald Trump's regime imploding on itself because of its extremism, number one, and its bizarre style as well?
Well, so far, what's been happening is, whether planned or not, I don't know. I presume it's planned. But what's happening is a kind of a charade, which is going on at two levels. At one level, Trump is making one outrageous claim or move after another. So, you know, the millions of illegal immigrants who voted for Clinton, Obama wiretapping his phone, whatever it may be. It's kind of like the birther business in the past. So one after another, the major media, say CNN, the New York Times, what are called the liberal media, I don't think it's the right term, but that's what they're called, they go after him. And so if you look at CNN, it's almost entirely going after the latest crazy thing that Trump did. That's what people pay attention to. Meanwhile, that's used to strengthen his base. He and his, you know, the guy, Steve Bannon, the guys who are running this stuff, can say, oh, you see, the liberals are trying to attack our guy. And in fact, support for him among his base is actually increasing because they see themselves as under attack from the liberal elites who are trying to undermine their spokesperson, or their spokesman, by demonstrating the absurdity and falsehood of his claims. At the same time, at another level, we have Paul Ryan and his gang pushing through legislation of the most extreme, savage end of the Republican establishment. Step by step, that's what they're doing, while attention is focused, and here the Democrats are substantially to blame, in my opinion. Attention is focused on other things, which are the one or another outrageous act. Now, it may be that the outrageous act will be so extreme that it'll implode. But so far, the game is working pretty well.
Noam Chomsky and Ralph Nader in a third installment of a long, brilliant, and eye-opening discussion they had in May 2017. Thanks to the Ralph Nader Radio Hour for the original recording. And thank you for listening to New World Notes. Find us on the web at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. We come to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. I am Kenneth Doust, and I not only thank you for listening, I also advise illegitimi non carborundum, and I hope you will come back again next week. Till then.